Everything we've talked about up until this point has touched on the consequences of colonialism for Indigenous peoples. In our last session, we discussed the harmful impact of assimilation. In the sessions that follow, we're going to shift the conversation to talk more about ways in which Indigenous peoples have sought to regain their independence, their dignity. So let's begin with leadership and governance. But I want to again acknowledge that we are on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. Kathleen, certainly residential schools were not the last devastation for Indigenous children and their families. Give us the definition of what's come to be known as the 60s scoop.
Well, the 60s scoop, I think it can be fairly said, was the next iteration of the assimilation of Indigenous children, because the era of residential schools basically wound down in the 60s and 70s. And so what was left was the devastation caused by those schools in terms of parenting skills, in terms of the harms, the psychological, physical harms of residential schools. And that had an impact on the intergenerational population of Indigenous children. So obviously the poverty and the devastation in the communities was shown in the ways in which children were existing.
Were being raised inside.
Were being raised, and the federal government had betrayed First Nations by handing over to the provinces in the Indian Act amendments in the 50s, the ability to make laws to control Indigenous peoples as well. So there was two governments now that they had to deal with, and the provinces took over child welfare. And that's when the 60s scoop happened, because instead of looking after these children and making the conditions and helping them live in a situation where they would be healthy and be able to experience their culture and their languages, they just took them out. The child welfare authorities took them out and had them adopted by non-Indigenous families in Canada, in the US, and even abroad.
So we're talking about 20,000.
Thousands, yes, thousands and thousands
mass
of
children. Mass removal
of children,
yes, from the reserves into adopted homes.
That's
again,
right.
Without parents really
having
any say.
With the view that only white people could raise these children properly. So it was deeply racist and, again, you know, furthering this idea that Indigenous people had to be assimilated into white culture or into European culture.
Uklasis Jeanette a Kwayakshil a Hauset Aksup Neutronalt At Umixu Stella August Nonixu Ida Swan Augustish Tatneas Ocean Tea Talsin Ushakshi Kleets Mississauga the Credit Honoshoni and Wendat. My name is Jeanette a Kwayakshil. I'm an Ahauset woman from the Neutronalt Nation. My name means one who gives away and still stands tall. I'm a daughter, I'm a granddaughter, and I'm a mother of three.
So my name is Steve Teakins. I'm Ojibwe from Nipissing First Nation, and I currently live in Toronto with my family, and I'm the executive director of NAMI Res, Native Men's Residence here in Toronto. So I'm the child of adoption scoop survivor. I know my mom was scooped in the late 50s. So yes, there was a lot of people taken in the 60s, but I think the first wave of people were taken in the 50s.
I'm thinking about how colonization has impacted my life personally, and it really represents coming from generations of broken homes. And it wasn't until I got to university and a combination of things happened. One, I was learning about the impacts of colonization on Indigenous families because I was studying social work. And the other thing I experienced was a book that said, "Don't Blame Mother," in a self-help bookstore. And it sent me to counseling, because information is power, and when I was informed of the systemic policies of racism and assimilation in this country, I realized it was no longer my mother's fault that I was raised away in foster care, multiple foster care homes. I ended up getting my child in care file that I actually donated to the Truth and Reconciliation, because as a mother of a residential school survivor, she had six children and was never in the same room with any of those children at the same time. And I had one photo taken of the surviving children from my mother, and two had already passed away. And when my mother saw the blanket, she nearly vomited. She was so overcome with emotion because she'd never seen her children in the same photograph, let alone the same room.
I remember my mom telling the story about the day she was taken away. She was taken with one of her siblings, one of her younger siblings, She came from a family of 12. And I guess when she was taken away, she described a car coming into the reserve and other children running away. And they grabbed my mom and sister and threw them in the back of the car and took them away. And she remembers looking out the back window and seeing her siblings chasing after the car, trying to stop them. She described going on a long drive and eventually ending up in a farm and laughing because the people at the farm spoke funny. And the reason they spoke funny is because they spoke French. Not to say that French is funny, but just it was a different language she wasn't accustomed to. And she stayed there until she turned 18. She did a lot of farm labor. And she was raised, I guess, as if she was French Canadian. And she lost her first language, which was Anishinaabemowin, and lost a lot of connection to family.
I had grown up so far away from my family, and I was very lucky that I got to stay with my little sisters. My three brothers were adopted to three different white homes, and my little sisters and I went in and out of foster care, and we stayed with the same foster family for a better part of our childhood. And they let us go visit my grandma and my cousins would come to us. And that wasn't everybody's experience, especially people who were adopted in this country. They were severed. Even their birthdays were changed. That's how insidious the systemic racism was, so that when they tried to find their families, they had the wrong birthday. So if people were looking for each other, they didn't even have the correct information. So how has assimilation affected me and my family? It has made us work harder to be proud of who we are. I tell my children, we're royalty in this country. We don't come from away. Our blood comes from these lands and waters since the beginning of time.
The loss of language was something that I wasn't able to regain, nor my mom. And I know people that speak the language fluently, there's different cultural understandings that you can't gain from other languages. And it talks about deep connection to the earth and deep connection to ways of understanding. I understand even jokes in the language are funnier in the language than they are in English. So there's deep understandings within the language that helps people to connect, I guess, to our culture, to our roots, to the earth.
So. Like my last name is A'akwayakshish, which is a mouthful. But when I changed it legally, and my five-year-old could say it, it's takes a bit of practice, but I don't change how to say it, right? So make the effort, just like any languages, you know, especially this time of year with school starting and, you know, we're speaking with newcomers in this scene. We often English up our names. I changed my name because CBC Radio wouldn't say it. They would say my former married name at the time, but to me, A'akwayakshish is my real name because my community gave me that name at a public ceremony, meaning one who gives away and still stands tall.
Well, the work I'm doing now, I guess it helps to help others, I guess, to reconnect to culture. I like thinking that when people come to Namires to seek services, that when they leave in better condition than when they came. So some of the work we do is we help people to not be homeless, right? So the way to not be homeless is find housing. So at Namires, you know, we create affordable housing for people. We develop it. We also have a lot of cultural programs that help people to reconnect to their culture and promote healing that way, so that hopefully when they leave here, they leave emotionally strong and spiritually strong as well.
I'm not going away, and I'm done being colonized. I changed my name because I wanted to bring my whole self into every conversation, and that means bringing my identity with me, because as a kid I had no choice but to put that on hold. I wore a perm as a little girl to try and hide my identity. I tried to bleach my hair when I was a teenager. I plucked my eyebrows beyond recognition because I didn't want to look like I had big bushy West Coast eyebrows. And you know, I tried to change my identity. I thought I was going to have blonde babies because I grew up with blonde Barbie dolls. So I say my name because I respect the responsibility that comes with it. I revived a tradition. If you like something I'm wearing that's not personal, you have to dance for it at a public event. So I revived a tradition that brought a lot of joy to community, and they appreciated it enough to give me this name.
Phil, this really seemed to just drive home the desire and the push again for self-governance, this latest indignity, if you will, of mass removal of children.
Well, that was a major staging point, if you will, in this gradual evolution from total dependence on the government for all of the decisions that mattered in our communities to the point where we are now, where we are in many situations exercising control and management over our affairs. But it didn't happen overnight. I mean, for example, we have a national political organization called the Assembly of First Nations. AFN, which is actually known by its corporate name still, the National Indian Brotherhood. Before then, the government had resisted any attempt on the part of our people to organize nationally. And one of the first organizers was a fellow, Loft, from the East. And he was a veteran. And he was undercut by government. Government went across the country to, in effect, to defame him. And the next major step was by a fellow here in Squamish, the late Andy Paul, was a formidable influence on chiefs and councils across the country to organize, to become a political force. And he was well regarded by the church. He received a couple of medals from the Pope and for all of his hard work. And as successful as he was in generating enthusiasm and support for his ideas, it never came into fruition as in terms of creating this national political representative body.
Is that because it's not one monolithic group, the indigenous peoples?
Yeah, that's true.
First Nations, Inuit, Métis.
But First Nations are incredibly diverse. We speak so many languages. We have distinct and unique cultural practices and traditions. And those are matters that you can't set aside or dismiss when you're talking about politics, political development, the organization of political interests. But the first person to actually succeed in creating a national representative political body for First Nations and Métis was Bill Watney from Saskatchewan, a lawyer. And his organization lasted for, about 5 years.
What years are we talking about,
roughly? In the 60s, early and mid-60s. And they were battling about whether it was going to be urban-centered or First Nations-based. But out of those very acrimonious discussions, a national political organization and it was created. But then the chiefs made a decision. They were going to create an organization that is specifically for Indians, or status Indians, not for Métis, not for the Inuit. And that's how the National Indian Brotherhood came into being. And that's how the National Indian Brotherhood came into being. The Assembly of First Nations is the political arm of the corporate body, the NIB, the National Indian Brotherhood. The Assembly of First Nations is the political body representing all the diverse First Nation communities in the country. And
what were your years of leadership?
2009, 2003, 6 years, and then interim when I was national chief from 97 to 99, I believe.
How much had it differed what you were fighting for and what was in the 1960s, the actual goal of self-governance?
There, there are some fundamental differences. Absolutely. In the old days, people made their own way. You know, for example, if the chief from my community wanted to travel to Ottawa to meet with the political people, the community had to pay his way. They'd have to raise money. And that was so for First Nations leaders in every part of the country. They paid their own way, right? They organized on their own strength and their own resources. But when the Assembly of First Nations or the National Indian Brotherhood came into being, the government financed much of what the NIB did. And that flowed out from in force with the 1982 constitutional talks. That's when the Inuit, the Métis, and the AFN became political voices with distinct powers and interests.
That, a pivotal time in Canadian history.
Oh, for
history.
Sure.
Before we get there, I want to, just in case people don't fully understand, and maybe Kathleen, you can weigh in, how does Indigenous governance differ from Western democracy?
Well, as Phyllis said, it's very diverse. And prior to contact, Indigenous people governed themselves in different ways. They entered into treaties with each other. They had their Indigenous law that they followed. So the style of government would be different depending on where these Indigenous nations were located and who they were dealing with and such like. Nowadays, there seems to be two basic ways of governing. One is through the Indian Act governance, which the government forced on Indigenous peoples, meaning chief, elected chief, and elected band council. And then there's the hereditary form of government, where the chief has inherited that role because of his lineage or hers. And so often these two styles of government come in conflict, which was the Wet'suwet'en situation.
I was going to say, this really is the perfect way to get into some of these flashpoints, and that was definitely one of them.
Sure.
One of the biggest.
And what the situation there was a conflict between the jurisdiction of the traditional chiefs, which was over the territory, the historic territory of the Aboriginal group in question, and then there was the jurisdiction of the elected chiefs, which is over reserves. The Indian Act gives elected chief and council jurisdiction to make laws and to govern over the reserve. That's it, that small piece of land. Whereas the hereditary chiefs, their traditional jurisdiction was over the whole territory. Well, when it came to the issue in Wet'suwet'en, the Coastal Link gas pipeline was going through traditional lands. The reserve chiefs were saying yes to the pipeline because they entered into favorable agreements with the company, but the traditional chiefs said no. And it was really the traditional chiefs' consent that was required because it was their territory that they had responsibility for that the pipeline was going through. So the consent really of the elected chiefs was irrelevant at the end of the day. However, when that went to court, the court wasn't recognizing Indigenous law, which governed what the hereditary chiefs said their jurisdiction was. They only went to the Indian Act. And so it looked like there was consent. An injunction against the protests was issued by the court and really enforced through violence. So instead of using a diplomatic approach, recognizing Indigenous law and this form of governance that had been set up over hundreds and hundreds of years, they focused only on the colonial set of rules and regulations, and violence followed. So really, that was in violation of UNDRIP, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which says that traditional forms of governments must be respected. It was in violation of even the Canadian government's commitment to allow self-government and require informed consent before decisions were made. So the Wet'suwet'en situation shows a problem in Canada, which is the lack of real recognition.
And that's only one example.
Yes.
And I think that it's important, without itemizing every single one, because there are actually a lot, but other conflicts that have threatened Indigenous sovereignty, Phil.
One of the most famous situation was the Six Nations. They forever refused to be sanctioned by the Canadian government. They wanted the Confederacy to rule, in effect, to run their community. And the government, essentially at the point of a gun, forced the Six Nations people to accept the federal Indian Act rules of electing your chief and council. And so that's what happened. The Confederacy, in the eyes of the government, was set aside, and in its place as this recognized governing body for the Six Nations, chief and council. And keep in mind that the Six Nations are the most populous First Nation community in Canada. They're band elections. The turnout is incredibly low for the election of chief and council.
Because
the Confederacy people, the vast majority of the people in Six Nations believe in the Confederacy. And it's been problematic, because who do you speak to when you go to Six Nations for a decision on any issue, on any self-governing or self-government issue? Government officials say, well, I have to go speak to the elected chief or the elected chief and council. The Confederacy people say, no, you come to us. We're the traditional leaders here.
So this internal struggle within each First Nations, is it every single
one?
Well,
not every single First Nation in Canada would be based in the same way, would have the same foundation as the Six Nations people on the Grand River. They've held firm to their traditional ways, their traditional belief system and their governance structure. And they essentially resisted all attempts on the part of the Crown to change, right? The very first time that the Confederacy was officially recognized was when Jim Prentice was Minister of Indian Affairs, when he reached out to both Chief and Council and the Confederacy. Six Nations is a matriarchal society, so the leaders are chosen by the women, right? And much in the same way that matriarchal societies on the West Coast here, right? The Wet'suwet'en people are hereditary. They're not selected as leaders of their territory through the Indian Act. They're born into their positions. And so they go directly against the people that still follow the dictates of the Indian Act. The chief and council are elected by and through the Indian Act. So when the decision on Wet'suwet'en came out, it was the hereditary chiefs that held force. But the Supreme Court made it very clear that the hereditary leaders would have to engage with the elected people. And that there was this 23-year interval where neither side came together to try and figure out how to manage and their territory, even though the court decision had made that very clear. And then what emerged was this major conflict where the hereditary people and their followers erected blockades, right? And the minister, and when Minister of Indian Affairs went out there, I think it was Carolyn Bennett, the provincial counterpart, they reached out to the hereditary people, the hereditary leadership, putting, imposing further conflict in those communities.
The struggle between elected band leaders and hereditary chiefs. If without resolution on that, how do you ever get actual functioning self-government?
Well, most communities in Canada, whether you're from this part of the country or Mi'kmaq or the Cree from Northern Quebec or you're Odinak or Ojibwe from Ontario, Cree from Northern Manitoba, most of the First Nation communities are governed by elected chiefs and councils. A number of them, maybe at least 50%, are elected through their own custom. But the custom of the band, in terms of the election of chiefs and councils, still and must be sanctioned by the Minister of Indian Affairs. So you have a split, right, in terms of those people that have elected their leaders through custom of the band, and those that have elected their chiefs and councils through the Indian Act. Do they have different powers? No, not really. They don't. They don't have more powers. The custom elected chief and council doesn't possess more self-government powers than those that are elected chiefs and councils. It's essentially the same, except when you have major land or territorial issues like the Coastal GasLink and the Wet'suwet'en people, then who prevails there at the moment? It would be the hereditary people. But in our part of the country, Manitoba, every chief and council there is in effect regulated by the Indian Act in many jurisdictional matters, whether it's provincial law, for example, on child welfare, the federal government in terms of funding for education, for example, even though that's also a provincial matter, but education on reserves is a federal matter, right? So
this still begs the question, how can you move forward if there is so much dissension within a First Nation community on how leadership should look?
Well, I wouldn't suggest that this distinction, an imposed distinction, has paralyzed First Nation communities from moving forward. But from time to time, the issue of whether you're an Indian Act chief or a custom elected chief and council comes up, but it's not a formidable kind of matter. Our chief and council in our community elected according to the laws of the community, but you know you still have an electoral officer, you still have scrutineers, no different than if the election was held under the rules of the
It's more of a process issue. At the end of the day, it's how people want to see their power structure implemented and put into place through an election or through an appointment or through hereditary. But at the end of the day, Lisa, the reality is everything is still controlled by the federal government. It's still controlled by the federal government. And even in the modern treaties and in these big land claim deals, ultimately they only come to fruition once the government passes legislation to allow them. See? So, you know, you talk about self-government, it's limited. And the constant battles in the courts that we hear about have to do with how much self-government these communities can have. It's about the scope. Because you see, when we got those changes to the Constitution in 1982, under Section 35 of the Constitution, it recognized Aboriginal rights, but it didn't define them.
Yeah, existing Aboriginal and treaty rights.
What are those existing rights? And so the battle is, we think they mean this. We think it means we can have self-government to this extent. So the courts are very reluctant to make any sweeping decisions, and so they go step by step, very incrementally, right? And so some of these breakthrough decisions, like the early decisions that recognize that, yes, this constitutional change does give Aboriginal rights, the courts are still reluctant to clarify what those rights mean. So even in the most famous fisheries case, which was here on the West Coast, they said, yes, fishing is an Aboriginal right. But they didn't go so far as to say, but the reserve government can set the regulations about fishing.
In the Marshall decision on the East Coast, the first decision was a magnificent victory for the First Nations there in terms of fishing, their right to fish and to create a First Nations economy based on the fishery. There was a great hue and cry on the part of the non-Indigenous fishers and the people and their governments. So the Supreme Court came with an explanation, a decision that explained or tried to explain what this decision meant, and they introduced this notion of a moderate fishery.
Yeah, which right? has never been done before and never been done since. But the pressure, I guess, was so great on the court, like, how dare you give this open-ended right to Indigenous peoples, that the Chief Justice came back and said that what it meant was a modest living.
A moderate livelihood from the fishery.
You couldn't become wealthy. You could only fish to the point that you were moderately well
off. It forces the question, though, once again, coming up with some kind of, in the modern era, cooperation between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples when it comes to the economy, some kind of a fair look. And where is this country on that level?
Well, we still have, remember we talked about differences in perception, right? Signing the first numbered treaties on both sides. The government's perception was this is a real estate deal, a cheap real estate deal. We're going to get all this land. On the Indigenous side, this is a sacred bargain where we can share the land for our mutual benefit. So we have these two solitudes, right? In the modern treaties, it's the same thing. The Indigenous people want to control their lives. They want to control their cultures. They want to control their destiny. The Crown, on the other hand, wants to enter into these modern agreements to give certainty for the oil companies, for the mining companies, for the hydroelectric companies, so that they will invest, right, and produce further wealth for the country so they can tax them. So until such time as these two groups can come together with some mutual understanding, respecting Indigenous law so that we could avoid the Wet'suwet'en situation, avoid those injunctions, instead of throwing people in jail for disobeying the injunction, sit down and talk to them as a diplomatic exercise between nations. This is what's not happening.
So much of the conflict is two different worldviews, two different cultures, and at the same time, the need for settlers to develop and use land, so much of Indigenous lands were taken away illegally. Ipriboash was an issue where Dudley George was killed. Historically, he was from the Kettle and Stony Point First Nation. The Stony Point is where his family used to live until they were removed in the Second World War from that reserve in order for the army to build a base and to use for the land for training soldiers for the Second World War, and the promise was that after the war, the land would be returned. It never was returned. And he was protesting at April Wash with other people. The family took a wrongful death suit because he was killed while he was protesting by the OPP, who had come in to clear the area, Ontario Provincial Police. And we sued the government, the premier at the time, the OPP, and others for wrongful death. Sam George, the lead plaintiff, the brother of Dudley George, all he wanted was why and how did my brother die. Eventually there was an inquiry. The judge made a lot of recommendations how to deal with Indigenous people, which have affected policing in Ontario and other places.
There is no consensus on the part of the First Nation community or the Indigenous community, you know, an all-inclusive term. For example, in what UNDRIP means, United Nations on Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, UNDRIP. So, huge victory, as understood by most, because it's about self-rule, it's about land, it's about culture, all the issues that are of utmost importance to our people. And the government introduced legislation to confirm UNDRIP as the formula under which and by which governments will interact and engage with First Nation governments, Indigenous governments. But there are those in the community that say, we don't need UNDRIP. Why make such noise about UNDRIP? We have Section 35 rights under the Constitution that speak to existing Aboriginal and treaty rights for three distinct groups of Aboriginal people. Indians, it's still, the reference is still Indians, like the Indian Act, Indians, Métis, and Inuit, right? And so the argument there, I suppose, I'm not a lawyer, when you talk about Section 35 rights, that reference in the Constitution, is it a full box or is it an empty box? If it's an empty box, you proceed to define what those rights mean, right? And it's a gradual evolutionary process. You use court decisions, and there have been many, many court decisions favorable to the interests and rights of our people. The problem there is giving effect to those rights.
Right. And then the courts create these difficult tests, like the test of a right. They say that, well, if the right existed pre-contact, well, then we will recognize that right. So then First Nation was challenged on having bingo on the reserve. The court said that, well, bingo wasn't a right practiced prior to contact. So you don't have the right to regulate bingos. You can't have these bingos that you want to have
or
on
casinos.
Casinos, yeah.
Yeah, so this is how it works. The courts, like I said, are very reluctant to make any definitive sweeping decisions. So they'll go bit by bit by bit, giving a little bit here, but reluctantly, you know, giving that bit and holding back on really defining, just like the fishing case. Instead of saying, yes, you have a right to fish, and yes, you can regulate the fishery
or
your people. They didn't say that.
Or the very important case in British Columbia, right, about title. Mm-hmm. And the great excitement in the community because the Supreme Court talked about their title, recognizing their title, at the same time saying that the underlying title to these lands is still held by the Crown.
Mm-hmm. So what have you won?
Yeah.
You know, it's sometimes it is these huge protests. We talk about Wet'suwet'en and Oka. I mean, we could go into all of the major historical protests, and sometimes it really is sort of the quiet ones that have a profound impact, and one in our history that is so powerful and so profound is, Phil, I want you to tell us about the quiet act of resistance, Elijah Harper, and that moment in 1990?
Elijah was a national hero through the eyes of our people. The chiefs of Manitoba realized what was possible through the legislature. And we needed someone that would be able to speak for us in the legislature. And that person was Elijah Harper. I was Grand Chief in the province, and I knew that I'd talk to other people, right? And we talked about possibilities and opportunities to put a halt to the Meech Lake Accord, to have it declared defunct.
And just for people who may not know, the Meech Lake Accord amendment proposed amendments to the Constitution.
Over
the
time.
The whole question of Quebec as a distinct society.
This was designed to bring Quebec into the fold. And in the process, they laid out five conditions. The most important for us, First Nations in Manitoba, was this reference to the distinct society, right, of Quebec, their distinct culture, their language, their law. And so when we were politicking, if I can use that word, campaigning and whatnot in Ottawa and across the country, we thought our best chance was not the legal option, but political. The Legislative Assembly in Manitoba was our vehicle, and the voice for us was going to be someone from our community. And Elijah was a sitting member of the Manitoba Legislature. So he and I had breakfast at the Charter House to talk about what was possible. And it was just he and I. And he told me, well, I have my the riding, my seat. I've heard that there is a challenger. And there's a possibility I might lose my the nomination. I said, don't worry about that, Elijah. We have bigger fish to fry, bigger and more important issues than this. This is it, the Meech Lake Accord. And you can be the one that says no to this. And so he said, okay, I'm prepared to accept the opportunity and the offer to be the one that actually says no to the Meech Lake Accord. And so the chiefs were in assembly. I had an assembly at the Fort Garry Hotel. We were talking there, and much of the discussion was taken up on the issue of the Meech Lake Accord and Quebec's, the concessions to Quebec and how they might undermine the rights of Indigenous peoples. No, we didn't talk Indigenous, but the rights of First Nations. Even though we were assured, or they tried to reassure us, that we'll deal with you guys later, right? And so we, the entire assembly, walked over to the legislature, and they wouldn't let us in. So there was this big scuffle where the chiefs, pushed their way in. One of my supporters, a big chief from Pugatawagan, had a real nice sports jacket. They ripped it to shreds there by the guards. But they made their way in, and we were in the gallery. And Elijah, of course, saw all that support. He had an eagle feather in his hand. He said no. And over 12 days of sitting days, he said no 8 times. And out of this emerged this very quiet, humble, determined Uji Cree from Red Sucker. Said no. He said no 8 times. and he held sway because Newfoundland found out that this was coming down. They didn't have to put the accord to a vote, and that was the moment.
It was a moment.
Yeah, wow. And you know, you think about heroes, and heroes emerge from the most unlikely kind of moments, and this was so with Elijah. There are people that traveled to Mexico, to Oaxaca, I think, and they went into this very humble hut by one of the tribal people there. And there was Elijah Harper's picture.
That was me, eh? Kids. We went to Mexico.
Yeah.
We had a Airbnb or the equivalent of that then, and walked in, and there's a big poster of Elijah Harper in the middle of this tiny
that
little village.
That is really amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we obviously know how defeating Meech Lake impacted Canada, but how did it actually impact Indigenous people?
Well, we, at that moment, realized that if we spoke with a strong voice, a united voice, if we presented ourselves as unified in our position, we represented great strength. We represented a voice that could not be ignored, that the wishes of our people couldn't be just cast aside for the next round, because that's what we were being told. We will deal with Quebec first, we will deal with you later. We thought that was pretty insulting, right? Pretty insulting to us. And we had nothing against Quebec. We also recognized that Quebec, that had a distinct culture, distinct language, the law was distinct from the rest of the country, and that ought to be recognized for what it was. But if Canadians were prepared to do that, and the governments from one end of the country to the other were prepared to give that kind of recognition, why is it that the First Peoples were being told, you just get in line here, we'll deal with you later? And that was the moment that a real hero from our community emerged, Elijah Harper. And that was it. And the next time, actually, has been an evolution, right? Each time we take a step that furthers or advances our interests. And after Meech Lake, there's Charlottetown. After Charlottetown, there's a whole number of other developments.
Well, and ever since then, they've never had a federal-provincial meeting without having First Nations in attendance, because they realized that, well, we experienced Meech Lake, so we better, you know, listen to the
I was in office
voice.
When we convinced the premiers to invite us to the meetings, to have First Nations at the table, the Métis, the Inuit.
So that's going somewhere toward self-determination then.
That's right. So there isn't one meeting like Premier's gatherings where Indigenous people are not invited.
Progress.
Yeah.
And we have to discuss, of course, the guiding principles of all of that, which is Indigenous law, and that is where we'll go next. So Wet'suwet'en, Oka, Kanasitake, all of these flashpoints, all of these conflicts, of which there are so many more, but what would you say is the common thread?
The common thread is sovereignty. It's being in charge of your own destiny. Whether it's a piece of land at Caledonia, which had been in dispute since the 1700s, or whether it was a golf course being imposed on the Mohawks in Kanasitagi, it was all about sovereignty. In both instances there, those people could trace their protests back 3 or 4 generations. Idle No More, which was led by young people and women, essentially was about sovereignty, was about expanding the jurisdiction of Indigenous decision-making and equality. So, you know, from day one, the First Nations people have insisted that they are sovereign nations and that they're to be recognized as such. And each level of oppression is being resisted. And perhaps since the 80s, that has increased a lot because, you know, the demands of modern day society, the further and more sophisticated the populations become, the more obvious these problems are and the more needy the solutions, you know, for the people to break out of this cycle of poverty and disadvantage.
And the issue with poverty, of course, is fear. Fear on the part of the ruling parties, the governments, the ruling class, if I can use that term respectfully. When Elijah took his stand, he made this very important point that a room full of people had given him roses, and he had tears coming down. And he said, I love this country too. Right? And it wasn't about secession. Right? Every position that, every stand we've taken publicly about sovereignty and self-rule and self-government and being able to manage and control our own affairs has never been about secession, right? Seceding from the country, as the fear we had when Quebec was talking about sovereignty. They wanted to secede, if that's the right word, and the Crees of Quebec stood up and said, huh, this is our land. We want to stay in Canada. And that's so in every part of the country. But we want to be respected. We want our rights to be recognized. We have the ability and the right to control our own destiny. That's all we're asking for. And but you wouldn't think or have any reason to believe that government officials actually believe that. Because they put roadblock after roadblock. They resist all of our attempts to, in fact, put ourselves in a position where we are actually running our own affairs, making the decisions that directly impact on the rest on the interests of our people. Whether it's dealing with a mining company or having a pipeline going through our communities or having some logging operation here.
And the core of the reason they wouldn't give it that up or give it over is money.
Mm-hmm. And control. Power and control. Because money means power. And control means power. And the decision makers in Ottawa don't want to give that up. They don't trust the Indigenous peoples to make the right decisions, or they just want to maintain power and control. It's probably both, actually, my guess. But this, all you can do is judge by the actions that government takes. And the courts as well are nervous about getting ahead of government. They're supposed to follow, right, public opinion and public policy. So although increasingly people turn to the courts because of the lack of progress dealing with government, nevertheless, yeah, the courts have made very favorable decisions, but they're very incremental, and often the government just ignores the court decisions, which is very frustrating.
And as we explore self-determination, of course, through all of it, we're going to look at the guiding principle, which is Indigenous law. So that'll be our next conversation.